no more, no more.
It's the 30th of March 2010. You're tuned to Truth News Radio Australia. And I'm Harrowood Fenton. And tonight we're joined by Josh Jackson via Skype. And we're here to sort out a few things that have gone wrong with the planet. Welcome, Josh.
G'day, Harrowood. And hopefully we'll sort out a few things that have gone right as well. Point out a few positives along the way.
I was playing an old Slave song there to introduce the show, in a song of emancipation of slavery, and it was a song that was allegedly written at the end of the Civil War, and the blacks who fought against the Yankees used to sing it. But no more auction block for me. In other words, I'm not going to be auctioned anymore. I'm nobody's property. I'm not the goods and chattel to be traded by any owner. And, you know, the history of slavery in this world is quite a chilling one. It goes back many thousands of years, in fact.
Well, it's in a way, you know, it's still happening. It's still definitely happening in the old sense of the word in a lot of places around the world. But in a new type of slavery, it's happening by government debt, selling government bonds under the guise that the next generation of taxpayers will get jobs and will the government will do everything in its power to force you into full-time constant beavering, so you can pay your taxes and be a good taxpayer. And it's a type of servitude because you can't, you know, They have to have you doing that because they already have the debt out on you.
The slavery of modern man in the Western industrialized world is a tricky one. Some people can't see it. Many people can't see it, and yet it's so obvious. You know, the enslavement is actually really there. And you know, just to give an example to prove it, you know, when interest rates go up even by the tiniest amount, like, you know, a fraction of a percentage point, right? That is enough to push a lot of people into financial collapse. It happened a couple of years ago here. Obviously, it happened in the US, and they're talking now about that it could happen again because as the economy is supposedly picking up again, they're saying that they're going to start raising the interest rates again. But this just illustrates to me the fragility of most people's existence, that we're not really financially secure at all. Change, suddenly people lose their houses, they lose everything again.
Yeah, and you know, the thing that always makes me giggle is that people seem to think that governments have all these amazing tools at their disposal to help, you know, the economy or to do things. And all they have, folks, all the government has is the lever of interest rates, the little switch. They got one button. It's a one-trick pony.
Yeah, they just keep pushing that button.
Or they lower them. And, and it's not even the government doing it. It's the RBA. It's it's the Reserve Bank. And it's definitely put under pressure by governments, but mainly by private banking cartels.
Absolutely. Look, we've got so much material tonight to get through that I've decided to break it up into its subject areas, and I wanted to highlight the stories that we really have to cover, because there's a lot in our Twitter that's actually quite interesting and would be fun to talk about, but we're obviously not going to be able to. And I really strongly recommend our listeners to have a look through our Twitter feed, because things don't go in there lightly. We're going to try and cover some of the main themes of the last couple of weeks, because we didn't manage to get a show in last week. So for tonight, what I've done is I've broken up the show into a few different theme groups. Now, the biggest one, and I guess the one that we should probably start with, is internet filter, internet freedom, and internet copyright laws generally. Because what we're seeing, and you've probably been following this pretty closely, Josh, but you know, I've seen an interesting development just in the last week or two, is that the heavy hitters in the industries, in the high tech, in the internet industries, are actually coming down on the government against the internet filter, which is sort of good. I mean, it's certainly not a bad thing. Like, hey, Google's coming to our rescue. You know, Google's going to protect our freedoms. Well, okay, you know, that is kind of nice. It's kind of cool that Google is protecting our freedoms. But do we really want to rely on Google to do that? And that's why I really want to emphasize the fact that there really hasn't been an effective protest movement against what the government wants to do. And that in itself is a very worrying sign. It's like, you know, imagine if a patient is like getting infected by a germ, and then their immune system does nothing to deal with that threat. But then, you know, the disinfectant comes along and gets rid of the problem. You know, I mean, okay, Google is just going to come along and sort of threaten our government, and our government is going to back off a little, right? But the people, the force that represents our society hasn't stood up to the government effectively. We're just relying on corporations to do it. Hello.
Yeah, totally agree. It's this sort of mentality where someone else will look after it. It's a mentality of, the big problem there as well is you can set yourself up by saying, oh, Google's behind us now, I can back off. And then Google all of a sudden goes, well, if you filter it in this way, we're not too fussed.
Indeed, indeed. And there's even signs that the Greens might be going to go down that path, because they've said, see, the Greens are not 100% against the filter, even though you might have got that impression, especially if you went to the Parramatta picnic with the other, you know, 20 or so people who were there, where Lee Rhiannon spoke very passionately and very forcefully. And I was very impressed with what she said. But Lee Rhiannon is a state MP. She has no control over federal Green policy. Now, federal Greens have actually said something a little bit different to what Lee Rhiannon said, which is that they actually would go along with the filter, provided that there was an opt-in switch on it. Now, what that means is that everything would go ahead as the government wants. The filter would be put in, but there would be this extra feature in it where you, as the consumer, would be the one who activates it. But all control would be at their end.
Oh, see, it's ridiculous, folks. You know what that is? You know what that is? All that is a little... It's jumping in, it's taking the steps into the pool instead of jumping in the deep end.
Yeah, the baby steps into the deep pool.
Yeah, it's putting your little toe in first and then slowly creeping into it so you don't notice the deep, deep creep of the nanny state. It isn't anything that we should be like, ooh, yeah, that's a little bit better, isn't it? No, fail. A big fail for me.
A huge fail there. Well, let's keep our fingers crossed that the Greens do continue to support us. But we are not going to be, you know, we're not looking to the Greens. We're not looking to a political party. We're not looking to a corporation. It's about you and me, folks. It's about ordinary people. And 1st of April, which is only 2 days' time, it's an opportunity to get out there and do that. The April Fool's Day Gag the Filter event. Excellent opportunity if you live in Sydney. In fact, I think they're doing it in other states as well. I'm not totally up to speed with that.
But just Google Gag the Filter.
Yeah, Google it. And, you know, get out there, because that's an actual thing you can do. You can make a difference. And people who say, oh, you know, why should we protest? Why should we get out there? Why should we do anything? It never works. Okay, I really want to address that. I want to talk a bit to this mindset that a lot of people have got into, that protest is pointless. Okay, there's a couple of different ways, a couple of different angles we can attack it on. The first thing I'm going to say is that you shouldn't be thinking whether it's going to achieve X or Y objective from you doing it. You should be thinking, I need to do it as a statement that I'm a free person, and as a gift to those who might receive what you have to offer for now, for the future, even if it was one person that you could change by doing that, are you going to deny that one person the benefit of your knowledge by just refusing to go out and only just talk to your friends about it?
That's one way of looking. To me, the statement of, demonstrating or getting out there is pointless is like saying advertising is pointless. It does nothing.
Yeah.
Advertising, why would a company spend, why would companies spend billions and trillions of dollars on advertising? Well, it's to get an idea out there. It's to get a movement, a concept, a passion for a product. What we are doing, and this is a product that people have to actually spend money on and what, I mean, what a demonstration is on something you feel passionately about, conceptually, is getting the message out to get other people on board to buy the fact that, of the concept that you're demoing about. So there's no difference, really. You're getting out there and you're advertising a concept instead of a product.
Yeah. Okay. Now, look, there's a lot of stories that have come out lately. There's a lot of material that you can read, and you can read it on our site. Basically, the situation with the internet filter now is that there is a groundswell of pressure against it from big players in the industry. The government is under a lot of pressure. Now, I just want to add some new insights to the discussion that you might not have heard, because I did a bit of research into censorship in Australia, and that there's a great website, which I'm just going to get up right now, called libitus.net. And they've got just mountains of material on here.
How do you spell that?
libertus.net. It's a free speech website, an Australian one. And they've got a great section on here that shows Australian censorship history. Right. And this is censorship that's been taking place over the years under our existing system, which is currently managed by an organization called ACMA. Now, I can't remember exactly what those letters stand for, but it's the organization which is responsible for classifying media. And basically that refers to film, television, and radio, and doesn't extend into the internet, except they have also got, the ACMA has been managing an internet blacklist as well. Even though there's no filter, there is actually an ACMA blacklist for the internet. And currently that's managed in the sense that if an Australian website is seen to be hosting some of this banned material, the it can actually be taken down. The website itself can be taken down. Now,
yeah, but see that's now, the thing, right?
Nobody really objected to that, because it was transparent. It was a transparent thing.
I own a website. It was a commercial website, and someone in Russia copied it, flat out copied it, cloned it, and we basically got them shut down. I mean, we just rang up the service provider and said, "Look, they copied us." Totally took all our images, everything. Can you please sort this out? And they did, there's definitely things people can do. If people see something that's totally illegal, you ring up the service provider or someone and say, look, this is illegal content. And usually they in the country, or you email the service provider in the country that it's in, and they'll usually take down if that's to do with the local laws. And most civil places around the world have pretty strong laws against you know, despicable things like child porn and stuff. So there's really no need for a nationwide filter. I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, the question of a site that might need to be taken down extends beyond whether it's got illegal material on it. There's, like, as you said, the example, really good example, is like a site that counterfeits another site. And, well, that's a different type of kettle of fish, isn't it? But it's one where it has to be, you know, most people, administrators, will recognize that straight away. It's very obvious, very clear, unambiguous. Yep. A site's masquerading as another site. It's copied the content. Well, we just take it down. And a lot of these common sense things are already being done, you see. That's the way YouTube works. It's the way Facebook works.
Although that's the way the free market works.
Yeah. But there have been excesses there too. I mean, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying everything's totally hunky-dory with Facebook and YouTube. No, there's been serious breaches there where they've overstepped the mark. And again, we always have to be aware of that this can always happen. But, you know, it's a question.
But again, these are like where if YouTube censors itself, you know, if YouTube censors, for me, I don't mind because it's an autonomous, voluntary thing.
Exactly.
I've voluntarily asked to put my video up there. And if I put all my trust into YouTube and put everything I've got onto there and nowhere else, and then I get taken down for some reason, it decides, yeah, that's terrible, and we can all kick up a stink, but that's their choice.
But we still have the internet. We still have the free internet.
The free market then just moves everything across to a new site because everyone just goes, oh, stuff YouTube. We're heading over to some other site.
And that, to me, Josh, that is why Google, who owns YouTube, has never quite gone as far as we thought they might in censoring stuff, because they know that if they do, we'll all move somewhere else.
Exactly.
Because the people who've got something to say on the internet form a huge part of the users of the internet. And Google knows that if you start annoying those people by just hiding their content and not indexing their pages, they will get wind of it, you know? And so Google actually remains quite a, to my mind, like let's say you want to find out the most important information about a given subject, right? Yeah. And you just put that term into Google, you will get something quite different from what the government tells you is the most important information about that topic. And I think what Google gives you is more correct. In other words, and I encourage everyone to do this right now, put 9/11 into Google. You will get very, you know, the best quality information that we've got right up at the top of the search. Unfortunately, it's information that was compiled by citizens who have no access to confidential information, but it's the research of those ordinary citizens which comes right up at the top of Google, 911truth.org, WTC7.net, you know, sites just started by people with, you know, on a shoestring.
No, these aren't just people, folks. I mean, these are, just to add in there, and this is off topic, but these are professors, architects, engineers,
physicists. Yeah, I'm not meaning to downgrade them. I'm just saying that they didn't really have much money or power, you know, like they were just right. a lot of the sites were started by people who really had very little money at all, you know, and but then the professors came on board, and yeah, you know, like they had the information, and Google knows that they've got the information because Google monitors the traffic to those sites, and you know, it's just the law of the way. It's the incontrovertible law of democracy, really. The most people that go to those sites, it's the most relevant to that search. Therefore, it's probably got the best quality information.
Exactly. And for my money, it's all about voluntarism. Whereas if you put a whole web covered filter, I can't voluntarily move, service providers or anything. I'll just have no choice. It's just like, nah, you're stuck with this, and it's enforced by violence because Conroy reckons, you know.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
But to get back on the topic,
censorship.
Conroy.
Well, actually, I just wanted to quickly run through Australian censorship history because I want to alert our listeners to the fact that the existing censorship system has been quite controversial in itself. We have this system that is set up, and certain films, for example, have been banned, refused classification. That's what they mean when they ban it. That's what they say when they ban it. there's been really high quality movies that had great reviews from like Margaret Pomerantz, you know, David and Margaret, that were banned. And then they had a protest screening. This was a film called Ken Park, which I still haven't seen, but I'm planning to actually get it now because I'm curious. Because that's an example of a film which was critically, you know, respected, but they decided wasn't acceptable, banned, you know, and a lot of quite, you know, sensible people were really annoyed by that. There was another movie called Mysterious Skin, excellent movie about explored the psychological effects of child abuse, and it follows the life of a couple of guys. One of them becomes a homosexual, one of them becomes a believer in UFOs, and the seminal events that made them what they are turned out to be that they were both abused when they were like 4 or 5 years old. But really fascinating film. They wanted to ban that.
And they go on about, it's pedophilia or whatever like that. Yet, you know, the whole industry of sexualization of children is so pervasive and everywhere now. It is so disgusting. I mean, I just turn on the top four. I mean, look at Britney Spears, right? All of a sudden, she's too old to be sexual. You know, she was sexual. She was all, you know, the rage when she was wearing school outfits. And now she's a little bit too old, so it's not the case.
Yes.
And now we're getting down to Miley Cyrus, which is this teenager who, you know, is prancing about in bras and G-strings, and that's allowed? That's allowed for the kids to see? That's, you know, yet let's shut down the most amazing free internet thing of information. Let's really constrict it and allow under that guise, this ridiculous guise, when you know, what I'm pointing out is that the inconsistencies of society to this sort of topic, this disgusting topic of pedophilia, which is a really horrific topic, and it makes me sick even talking about it, because I just, you know, it is so sickening. They use these sickening topics because no one wants to talk about it. No one wants to talk about it because they think, oh no, don't want to talk about that. It's too scary, you know. So that's how then they just pass everything through. They pass these ridiculous laws.
Absolutely. Look, I'm just going to take a really short break for a promo. Just hang on there.
Sick of the lies, deception, spin, and half truths? Well, so are we. You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia. Tune in every week at truthnews.com.au or subscribe to the podcast with iTunes or your favourite podcatcher.
Okay, yeah, and do subscribe, speak to your friends, magnify the information that you get from us. Make sure that it doesn't just become contained. We don't want to be contained. We want to grow.
Yeah, we're not just entertainment.
Yeah.
We're not even edutainment. We're an outlet, we're a voice, and we also want your voice, you know. So leave us a message on the Skype line and we'll play them.
We will. We most certainly will. We most certainly will. Look, I want to. I want to move into the second part of this subject, because we've been talking about the internet filter. We've been talking about protecting the internet, and we get a lot of support now from organizations. Sounds really good, doesn't it? However, watch out, because at the same time, there's another threat coming, and it's coming blind. It's going to blindside a lot of people, and it's called the ACTA Treaty. Now, has anyone out there, I wish we could just do a quick poll and find out, has anyone heard of the ACTA Treaty? Because I'd only vaguely heard of it, you know. But, well, you know, it's not surprising if you haven't heard of it, because they've kept it secret. It's only actually been leaked. It's actually, believe it or not, it's been leaked by WikiLeaks. And again, I want to talk about WikiLeaks again in a minute. Yeah.
Godsend.
Yeah, look, it has been leaked. And Let me just tell you a little bit about the ACTA Treaty. What does it stand for, first of all?
Give us the rundown. Give us a rundown.
The Anti-Counterfeiting Trade Agreement is a far-reaching proposal that the US government has insisted was too sensitive to be exposed to the public. Now that the 44-page document has been leaked, it is easy to see why the US wanted to keep it a secret. ACTA, in its present form, is heralded by the film and music industries and their fight against piracy. However, if upheld, citizens will pay a heavy price for their privacy. Government can search, seize, and destroy electronics. Former President George W. Bush and current President Barack Obama both favor ACTA, which is a result of countless millions of dollars in international lobbying money from the media industry. ACTA was designed to enact the constant monitoring of everyone's online activities, both legitimate and non-legitimate, and gives border agents in the
U.S. Hang on. Can you just repeat that little bit there?
ACTA was designed to enact the constant monitoring of everyone's online activities, both legitimate and non-legitimate. Indeed. And we'll get back to that, because that includes things like, you know, monitoring your downloads through the ISP. If they detect you doing something wrong, they can cut you off, or a three strikes law. You know, you do it three times, they cut off your internet. That's all part of this.
Points, like a driver's license points system.
Indeed. But it gets worse. The treaty would give border agents in the US and other member states, and which would be Australia, because Australia is to be part of this treaty. We are going to be a signatory to the treaty. The power to search and seize your equipment without a warrant. Effectively, it gives these officials the power to destroy citizens' laptops, iPods, or CDs if the agents suspect that they might contain copyright infringing content. Now, I've read a bit about this, you know, comments, and some people are a little bit naive, right? Some people read and they go, oh, it's too hard. They'll never be able to go through my laptop and find my porn or whatever. You know, it's too hard. They'll never do it. Wake up, okay? Just to people who think that way, all I want to say to you is wake up, because you're living in a dream world, man. It's not a question of whether they're going to find the stuff on your computer and then they're going to say, gee, you shouldn't have this stuff. We're going to impound your computer. That's not what we're concerned about. That's not what I'm concerned about.
And they don't care about porn anyway. They don't care about music. They don't care about any of that.
Well, what we are concerned is about how this could just simply be used as a tool of total oppression. Because once you give guards that sort of power, they will abuse it, even on their own. But once you authorize that abuse of power from above, and any sign, for example, that person might be a dissident of some kind, or, yeah, you know, on the blacklist.
Leader of a resistance movement, or even a member of some sort of resistance.
It's a classic fascist thing, you know. That's how they eliminate their enemies. It's been done over and over again. It's just, it's a joke, you know.
No, very good pointing that out. Yep.
Yeah, and you know, people who are guards become classic little Nazis, right? There's a guy who, a security guard in the building where I work, and I'll just tell you this little story, right? Because it actually really, really annoyed me. This guy is, you know, in charge of, you know, the lobby of the building. And there's a rule that says no smoking out the front. Okay. So, you know, he goes out there and he yells and, you know, screams abuse at people just having a quiet smoke outside the building. Okay. You know, he's an idiot, but you just think, okay, I'll put up with it, right? But then I see the same guy about 5 minutes later in the lobby. And there's a courier who's come into the lobby with a little box about the size of his hand, right?
Oh, no.
And the courier's heading for the elevators. And this guy, this giant, he's got a huge gut, right? He stands in front of this guy saying, no, you're not allowed to use the elevators for deliveries. You've got to use the service entrance, right? Yeah. And the courier's going, oh, man, look, you know, I'm in a hurry. It's a little box. And the service entrance is right around the back of the building down a driveway that you're supposed to drive into. You're not even supposed to walk, you know. Yeah. And you've got to go right down into the basement and then up the elevators again.
Oh, no, but it's the rules.
But, yeah, but see, people get
it's
people
the
love
rules.
It. They just love it. And, you know, I hope, anyway, those people who do that, you know, have a price to pay somewhere down the line. Anyway, we're off topic. Continuing.
But also, I just want to quickly add, because I know I'm going to get this, that people are going to say, yeah, but see, you had something copied and you got them shut down. You know, like, the thing is, if I couldn't shut them down, I'm not going to go out there and lobby for the whole entire internet to be suppressed and crushed. I just try to make a better website. I try to be a better businessman.
Actually, you're making a really important point there. And I think, again, so our listeners don't get confused. For example, the Pirate Party has a very nuanced position on this. They don't support someone just copying content and commercializing it, right? What they support is the total decriminalization of non-commercial copying.
Mm.
Big difference.
Mm.
It really is a big difference. The site you're talking about, the only reason they would have copied your site was they thought they could make some money out of it somehow. They were going to try and commercialize the clone. And this is happening all over the place. There's cloned commercial sites popping up all over the world. And they're often associated with scams as well. Like, you know, if it's a site that sells something that's well respected, they'll set up a clone version of that tries to get people's credit card details.
Well, yeah, passwords and
Yeah.
Look, and I mean, there's a whole industry of copying physical DVDs and all of this sort of stuff as well. And like you said, it's a commercialization. It's people making money. But I mean, I said this to you the other day, Harold. I mean, I went to the library. I went to the public library the other day. And I thought, what is the difference in me borrowing Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged and reading it than me copying an ebook and reading it from a friend?
Excellent. Yeah.
What is the difference between that? If they use the concept of, well, you're taking by copying a song or an ebook or something like that, you are in fact taking future revenues away from the inventor of that or the creator of the content. And I just think, well, where does that lie in libraries? I mean, I'm doing the exact same thing. I'm not going out and buying the book. I'm going and reading it and consuming the information, even though I haven't bought it. And that is sanctioned by governments. They're public libraries. They're government run.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It was just an interesting observation.
Look, we're just gonna break for a little song. How about that? I'm actually gonna play that song that I started playing at the beginning, just this old Slave song, just a quickie, and then we'll get back into this. We'll just kick this one off right now.
Kick it.
Many thousand gone.
You're listening to Truth News Radio Australia, going beyond the spin, deception and propaganda of mainstream news. Visit truthnews.com.au and subscribe now. Okay, back to the coalface. no rest for the emancipated, for the newly emancipated freedom fighter. Once you escape from slavery, you realize that you must fight. I tell you.
Now I'll tell you one interesting thing that you have here that we have here in the list is that the Obama administration has questioned the Rudd government's plan to introduce this internet filter.
Yeah, that's the latest in a series of jaw-dropping developments. Yeah, the actual Obama administration now has questioned the filter. What can we say?
I don't know. It sounds very suspect. You know what? What makes me think there is, well, maybe they're thinking about a global filter.
Well, yeah. And
instead of an Australian one, oh, no, we can't have that. Let's just have a global one, you know. I don't know. Just to put that out there. Throwing that out there. I don't know. I've got no evidence. It's just a thought. Oops. Sorry about that.
You got your alarm going off there. Look, we've got some other some stuff we've got to cover now. I'll just go through the topic headings of what I want to talk about in the second half. One is back in the subject of psychiatry, which we covered last time. And there's really some really important things that we have to talk about there, psychiatry and big pharma. And talk about and also take action. I'm really, this is a call to action as well about that, some developments there. 9/11 truth, you know, one thing I really want to just draw people's attention to is the protest march in Los Angeles, where there was an amazing appearance by 9/11, really, really in their greatest form, showing that 9/11 truth is really the essence, the quintessence of what the anti-war movement is about. Just so important. Third topic is Israel. Israel is, again, one of those topics that you can't afford not to understand it, not to face it, not to see what is going on with Israel. And there's been quite a few developments in the relationship of Australia and the US, particularly with Israel, over the last month or so. Anyway, we'll get into that because I really want to highlight for our listeners that Israel, when you see what's going on in Israel, I don't think you should even think of it as, oh, that's just a problem for Palestinians. That's just a problem in Israel. I see what Israel is doing in Gaza, in the West Bank, as symbolic of what the New World Order, that we like to call it, is doing in all different ways to human beings. And the image, the metaphor of the bulldozer just crushing people's homes while they sit in their homes itself is such a powerful psyop. That's such a powerful psychological image. And it really summarizes what this brutal tendency is that we're seeing expressed in all these different ways around the world at the moment. And so we'll get back to Israel. But let me just, now that I've just covered those in brief, let me get into psychiatry gone mad. Okay. When we did our interview with Rochelle McCready last time, she briefly alluded to a psychiatrist by the name of Patrick McGorry, who, as it turns out, he is actually our Australian of the Year this year. And he's big in the news. You'll find he pops up all the time now in the news. He was... There was a big spread in the newspaper. He's actually going to be doing television commercials with GetUp.org. And it sounds terrific. You know, if you read the material, if you go to the articles that have been written about this guy, it just sounds like the man is like an angel from heaven, you know. And yet what I know, because I did the research before, is that this is a man who believes that children should be drugged, but he doesn't just believe they should be drugged when they're psychotic or when they're diagnosed. He believes that many children and teenagers should be drugged preemptively. What do you say? How do you like them apples? Yeah.
Oh, you just drug them all. I mean, they do it with fluoride, so why not just do it with everything else? Just chuck it in the water supply. You know, just look. They should just put every single, you know, ban marijuana and throw people in jail for that. Ban, you know, everything else, throw people in jail for that. But give them all sorts of pharmaceuticals which kill thousands of people a year, willy nilly, and let's just give them to children preemptively. Great idea.
And you know, they use these code words, like they use the word care.
Yeah.
And they use the word treatment.
Oh, yeah. It's all about NLP. It's neuro-linguistic programming. And that's what neuro-linguistic programming, it's a very modern science of using language. That's why it's called linguistic programming. It's using language to program people's subconscious mind, which then talks to its their conscious mind. So if you say something like care, We need to care for the children, and you know, these sort of things really help sway people. It's amazing.
Now, I'm just going to read to you from an article about Patrick McGorry. I intend to do something about this. I've been talking to some of the people who are active in this area. We're going to try and expose the complete fraud here. It's going to take a bit of an effort, but we'll get into that. But who is Patrick McGorry? Well, he's a psychiatrist just named Australian of the Year for his work in youth mental health reform. What does that reform consist of? He calls it a new form of climate change. Interesting phrase. He not only promotes youths being put on antipsychotics and antidepressants, cited by international drug regulatory agencies as causing hallucinations, hostility, personality change and life-threatening diabetes, strokes, suicide and death, but McGorry goes a giant step further, drug them before they've even developed a psychiatric disorder. Okay, the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child has expressed serious concerns about child drugging. And Senate investigations in the United States have found high-profile psychiatrists who are pharmaceutically funded and using fraudulent research being among the heaviest promoters of psychiatric drug use on children. While the rest of the world is experiencing serious alarm at the rampant use of deadly psychiatric drugs on children, McGorry pushes full steam ahead to increase the amount of children being needlessly subjected to psychiatry's most powerful drugs, antidepressants and antipsychotics. His theory and practices are so controversial that even his colleagues in the United States have backed away from it. And a parallel study done in the United States based on the same theory that McGorry uses was considered an abject failure even by the investigators themselves. Other psychiatrists have criticized McGorry's pre-drugging practice as unethical and harmful to adolescents. This is especially so as the symptoms McGorry and cohorts invented to pre-label youths as potential candidates for psychosis and schizophrenia are, according to one US psychiatrist, remarkably common. Adolescence is a period of life that is normally marked by tumultuous changes in personality. And what was the first thing he did to capitalize on his winning of Australian of the Year award? He demanded the Australian government hand over $200 million to fund more of his youth, you know, youth healthcare centres where he can drug more children. And the government is seriously entertaining this idea. Yet, for whoever nominated him, apparently an anonymous supporter, due diligence was not done on what McGorry advocates. A cursory look at his research shows that while behavioural symptoms are evaluated and on a hunch, behavioural symptoms are evaluated and on a hunch drugged to see if they prevent the outset of a mental disorder, there's no mention of the teens being given full and searching physical exams to first rule out undiagnosed and untreated medical conditions that may be causing it. Yet dozens of physical conditions can manifest as behavioural problems. Well, I won't go any more into that article, but what we have here is, it's prima facie. You just look at it. You don't really have to think too hard about it to see there is something very, very wrong here. And Australia is even out of step with other countries on this in promoting this guy, in lauding this guy with accolades and giving him, you know, more authority now. And he's now doing a series of television commercials. This is really sickening, okay? He is going to be doing a series of television commercials with getup.org, okay, to promote his program.
See, I mean, that's just demented. I mean, honestly, Australian loser of the year. Maybe.
Yeah. Look, now, just quickly, following on from that, I want to read this article here. Children as young as one are being prescribed antipsychotic drugs. Children as young as one are being prescribed powerful antipsychotic drugs that have been linked to deaths overseas. This was published in the Daily Telegraph, March 24, 2010. The strong medication is designed to quell psychotic episodes normally experienced by adults with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. There are concerns that some doctors are illegitimately writing scripts for preschoolers and primary school children for unapproved medical reasons. Figures provided by the Therapeutic Goods Administration showed up to 3,351 New South Wales children aged under 18 were prescribed the drugs in 1 year. And of them, that's just in New South Wales, and of them, at least 62 toddlers and age 5 and under were prescribed these drugs in New South Wales. 62 children have been under 5, have been put on antipsychotic meds, okay? We need transparency. We need to know what is going on. We can't stand by and just let this occur, folks.
I mean, that's child abuse. And what sort of parents actually let their kids of under five years old, I mean, even over 5 years old, take antipsychotic drugs? I mean, it's just...
And it says here that these drugs are not approved for children. Risperidol, Zyprexa. These are not approved for children. And side effects can be so severe in adults that elderly patients are warned that they have a higher risk of sudden death. So, common side effects: excessive weight gain, low blood pressure, increased risk of diabetes, painful muscle spasms. Now,
yeah, let's not try to give the children, you know, a good clean diet of some you know, raw foods and superfoods and you know, some really nice you know, an understanding of relaxation or some parenting skills, maybe. You know, let's not try to, you know, I mean, these sort of things are common sense things. Instead, let's get the medical industry in.
Another statistic here, in 2007-2008, 10,000 children under 18 were prescribed antipsychotic meds. Now, that doesn't include Ritalin, by the way. That's not... antipsychotic is a specific class, so that doesn't include all the other psychiatric medications that have been given to children. That's just antipsychotic. We know that actually the number of kids that are on the Ritalin, the drug prescribed for attention deficit disorder, is probably a lot higher than that. But you add it together. You add together all these different categories and classes of psychiatric meds. It's massive. The number of young people on these drugs is just massive. And we have to take action. And again, we can't sit back and hope that some organization will do it for us, right? Because getup.org is actually, you know, supposedly one of those organizations that defends your rights. Getup.org is defending this type of behavior. Okay. Sad to say. I mean, it's tragic.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, a couple more things on this list of just this evil list, really. It's just the evil list that we're going through here. Drug company Merck created a hit list of critics and even faked a medical journal in order to get doctors to buy their products. They faked a medical journal.
Wow. That's just taking it to the next level, isn't it?
You know, I know our previous guest we had on the show was saying that we shouldn't be too critical of the pharmaceutical companies. Well, I'm sorry, but...
Bring on the hit list, you punks.
I'm sorry, but I'm not taking that one lying down, okay? Merck was the creator of a drug called Vioxx, which is the subject of a huge class action at the moment in Australia and in other parts of the world. And it was Vioxx that they created this fake medical journal to promote. It says here that Merck's arthritis drug Vioxx has caused heart attacks, and that its Australian subsidiary knew of the safety risks but played them down to general practitioners. Merck's internal marketing documents and sales staff training manuals were tendered by the plaintiff, this is in a court case, as evidence of the lengths to which the company went in convincing doctors to prescribe Vioxx. This included allegations that Merck created a hit list of 12 doctors critical of the drug who needed to be neutralized. This is quotation from one of their documents. Came up with cunning plans to promote the drug to doctors at educational events, and even faked a medical journal promoting its product. In Melbourne, a federal court judge, Christopher Jessop, found Vioxx did double the risk of heart attack and did contribute to the one that the plaintiff had. So that's an important development there in the in the struggle for, because that becomes like a landmark case then, which will open it up. But see, that's why it's important. See, that man who took Vioxx to court, you know, he would have had a lot of people saying, don't bother, it's too hard, you might lose, blah, blah, blah. You know, do you see how important it is? That the one person who stands up to these people, if there isn't someone doing that, we are so screwed. Sorry, folks.
Yeah. And look, not every drug is bad. I'm not saying drug companies are evil because they create, you know, I'm sure there's some amazing drugs out there that really help people and all that. But it's when they start really going after little children, creating sickness that doesn't even exist to cure you of. You got to start questioning it, and when governments then come in and step in and become the violent enforcing arm of these corporations, that's called fascism. And when these two mix up to try and then build policy around who should take what, when, where, how you should take it, and if you refuse, then forcibly take certain drugs, you've just got to stand up. You've got to stand up straight away. And Australian loser of the year, you know, is trying to say that we, you know, need to forcibly, well, not forcibly, I don't know what he's precisely saying, but just the sort of notion that teenagers are hysterical and need to be drugged because they're, you know, they're withdrawing into their rooms, or they're you know, screaming back at their parents, or they're you know, hanging around weirdos, or they're you know, changing their look and all wearing black all of a sudden, or they're,
look, it's got just a an punk attempt to normalize human behavior.
Started getting piercings on their nose. I mean, that's what teenagers do, folks. I mean, I dare you to think back to when you were a teenager. You know, I bet you tried to rebel against your folks. And maybe it didn't last. Maybe you went back after, you know, a couple of years or even a couple of weeks.
But this attempt to normalize human behavior is going to create the very thing that they supposedly are trying to cure, because so many of these drugs have been found to cause psychosis. That, you know, antidepressants cause psychosis. You know, it's there's a feedback mechanism that occurs when you start messing around with people's brains. okay, and you start when they're young, and you say they've got a behavioural disorder, and that there's a pattern, there's a well-observed pattern with kids who are diagnosed with attention deficit disorder that they move on to actually having antidepressants when they're in their teens, and then they become psychotic. Yeah. And one drug causes the next symptom, which then they prescribe another drug for, which then triggers the next symptom. So there's a complete lack of logic. But as we've seen with every fascist period in humanity, there's always been a lack of logic. Look at what the Cambodians did.
Lack of empiricism, lack of any sort of, you know, decency.
Yeah, the Cambodians wanted to create a paradise on Earth, you know. They called it the Year Zero. They're going to have this wonderful, you know, agrarian utopia. And then they decided they had to, you know, that school teachers had to all be killed, you know, because they were just too dangerous. I'm just saying, it's illogical, isn't it? They wanted to create a utopia and they went around killing people. Mm. It's illogical to do that. But and you'd think, why would they do it if it's illogical? And it's like, okay, well, the people who are doing this aren't actually going out and actually shooting people. You know, they're not going into people's homes and shooting them, although they are doing that in Israel. Okay. But, you know, they're doing different things in different places. But what they're doing here is not so obvious that it's a barrel of a gun in your face. People always try to justify it, though, you see. They justify the behavior of power. And they try to find a reason for why it's okay to have this done. You know, it's like I needed it somehow, and that's the thin end of the wedge of how the fascism takes over.
There's also this thing where, I voted for them. I voted for Labor, and they're the ones pulling this in, and I don't want to look like a bad guy because I was telling all my friends about how good Labor was, so I don't want to say that it's a bad thing what they're doing.
The fake left-right paradigm has so much to blame for this. Mm. And that, you know, that just keeps people locked into their little mindset that they formed when they were like 18 years old, you know, they vote for, what they believe in, and they just stick in this little tunnel for the rest of their lives.
Yeah.
Anyway, look, let's move on. I just want to quickly digress to another wacky topic, because actually this topic summarizes something I think about, as we were saying, the mental state of the average person in our society. The story is French Game of Death shocks audience. Now, this is it was a documentary that was made by some French filmmakers. And what they did is they got all these actors and they got people off the street who believed that they were actually going into a television studio, and they actually had actors sitting in the studio, and it was supposed to be like a quiz show, right? Yeah. But when the guy got the question wrong, he was given an electric shock by the contestants. And I'll just play this little brief sting here from the news story about it.
Sometimes you need tomorrow to finish what you started today. For the aches and sleeplessness in between, there's new Motrin PM. No other medicine, not even Advil PM, is more effective for pain and sleeplessness.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't recommend that. PM. Stay away from that drug.
A French documentary will attempt to show the power television holds over its viewers. Contestants in a fake game show were asked to give electric shocks if the other participants, who were accomplices, gave wrong answers. Well, over 80% of the contestants were apparently prepared to inflict some pain. Only the host and the accomplices were aware the game was actually an experiment.
Okay, that's enough of that.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to an old experiment by a guy called Milgram. This was, I think, 1961, Yale University. Where Milgram, you know, asked volunteers to basically deliver an increasingly large electric shock to people and have then a person in a white coat sort of be the authority figure. And he was surprised to see how many people would actually, you know, and they would have this wall in between, and you just, all the person would hear is these gurgling screams of an actor supposedly receiving the shock. And The thing is with this experiment, Harrowood, is that it's been made. It's been done so many times, and it's been seen so many times because of the internet. A lot of people actually know about this experiment. So, even people on this game show, if they knew about it, they would take it all the way because, you know, and pretend they don't know about it or something like that.
Well, they actually said it was made as a documentary, and they do have interviews with the people afterwards, and it said that. I mean, I'm taking it at face value that it was actually genuine, and that, you know, that they said that a lot of the people were quite disturbed at what they had to do.
Look,
and a lot of them needed.
Whether it was genuine or not, the fact of the matter is, a vast majority, 29 in the original experiment, they pushed all the buttons all the way up to the top. So if you, they would say, oh, you know. 500 volts is enough to kill a person or whatever it is, and the machine's top lever goes up to, you know, 40,000 volts or something, and basically every question that they get wrong it jumps up, and vast majority of the people would go right up to, you know, the last two levers and be, I mean, they're unwilling, they were sort of, oh, really, do we have, and they'd be questioning the authority figure in the white coat going, really, should I, and it wasn't even a policeman, folks, it's not even a hard authority figure, it's just a dude in the white coat, and they're all volunteers in there, and they can leave at any time. They can say no. There's no punishment for them to do it. There's no punishment for these people to actually push the shock. So imagine if you put that sort of pressure on, well, if you don't do it, then we're going to do it to you or something like that. I mean, just shows what, you know, the sad state of affairs.
Well, the message you should get from this is that when people tell you that something that you know is totally unjust is okay, that and you know in your heart that it's totally wicked, And yet the person next to you at work just shrugs their shoulders and says, come on, it's all right, you're overreacting, you know. You know, to a home in Gaza being bulldozed with people inside it, you know. You know, it's okay. It was okay to do that. That's
well,
the
then
same...
you stand up and say, no. No, it's not okay. And you be vocal. But and that's what not enough people are. You know, the thing is, we've been so conditioned to be to not be in confrontations, and this is the funny thing about the internet. People will get in confrontations all the time on the net. They're so willing to get on there and have full on rants and write the most abusive, you know, feedback and stuff. And this person was the worst to deal with on eBay or whatever, or on YouTube. You see really nasty stuff, but in face to face. No one's willing to confront anymore. And I think it's important not to be aggressive or start fights or anything, but it's important to be assertive upon wickedness. You know, when you see something that's not just, not right, you stand up and you have your point of view, for God's sake.
Excellent, excellent point. And I've just provided a segue into the next topic that I wanted to talk about tonight, which is Israel. And I'm encouraging everyone who's listening to the show tonight to watch this documentary, The Children of Gaza. It's going to be up on the site. It's currently posted at 911oz.com as well. It is a really important film. You've got to watch it. You've got to see it. It was done by a very skillful team of people. It's all just interviews with children mostly, and it's done within the last year. And you can see what the impact of that to call it a war is a total misnomer. It was not a war. It was a massacre. What Israel did in 2008, 2009, that December, January incursion into Gaza was a massacre. Because there was no enemy. There were no battles. There were just tanks and bulldozers. And, you know, there were rockets being fired, but they never actually had any battles. The rockets were just being fired here and there by people that, I mean, the rockets were just these tiny little handmade things that, you know, it's a miracle if one ever actually hits anyone. Anyway, it's another story. But the fact is that...
But, you know, the thing is, Harold, it's the poor Jews on the other side as well that are getting these families that are just trying to eat and sleep and do their own thing are getting hit by these bombs, the retaliation bombs, this blowback.
Well, that's right. I mean, there have been.
Side, you know,
it was Israel that broke the truce as well. Yeah, exactly.
And it's the states, these states and these banks forming these corporate sort of, again, these fascist sort of partnerships between state and private banking and infrastructure companies and stuff that are really forcing this the major Zionist lobbies which is not a Jewish thing. Zionism it's a very big topic and stuff, but there's whole groups like Jews Against Zionism.
Look, I'm just going to play 5 minutes or so just to whet your appetite about this documentary. So just let me just kick it off. Some excellent footage here as well.
Ibrahim. Omsiat. Brother and sister Amal and Mahmoud. All children of Gaza who 15 months ago lived through a devastating invasion. This is the story of how they have tried to rebuild their lives over the past year. After the dead are buried and the physical scars begin to heal, what is the long-term impact on a child's mind of seeing their home turned into a battlefield?
Obviously, it's a bit hard to listen to that without the subtitles there. Anyway, the kids make a really... the kids in it are so beautiful, though, I tell you. They're not... They don't look like downtrodden people at all. They're clear-eyed. They're very articulate. And each one of those children, when they're interviewed, makes these really profound statements. Honestly, it'll bring you to tears. They are forced to become very mature very quickly when they go through these types of things. They see their parents being killed in front of them. They see their brother, their sister killed in front of them. They see just chaos. You know, they see a normal life suddenly just turn into chaos. Just, machinery just crashing through the wall of your home. The film also goes into the current situation in Gaza where the blockade is still in force. So there can be no rebuilding because the Gaza is totally blocked. They can't get any building materials in. And, the weird thing about this, Josh, again, and we're talking about this thing about how illogical it is, because what the Israelis are doing is creating the very thing that they supposedly are defending themselves against, because again, you'll see it from the film. They've created a new generation of hardened warriors, hardened enemies of Israel.
That's what I'm saying.
That will never, ever give in. They will never give in. Those kids, when they grew up, there will be nothing you could do to change their mind.
And
nothing.
Folks, imagine if this happened to you. If someone just started invading your country, and that your parents got killed and everything like that in your home that you've lived in, what do you think? You just go, I guess you guys deserve to live here. No, I mean you would become so hardened and angry and mentally screwed over. Pardon my language, but you've really, a lot of people just think, all these terrorists, they're terrorists. Where do these terrorists come from? They come from a very, 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 awful scenarios, mostly. I mean, you do get these ridiculous patsy terrorists that live in common England and stuff, that's a whole other story. But a lot of these places, that it's exactly right, Herod. When you keep at, you know, instead of giving food and blankets and talking or just, you know, supporting one another and trying to figure out some way around this, let's just keep knocking down, smashing, retaliating. And it's so inhumane, and it's...
You know something interesting, Josh, did you ever see the film Schindler's List? Spielberg film about the Holocaust. In that film, there's a famous scene where the SS commandant of the concentration camp stands on his balcony with a gun with, you know, sights in it, you know, target, you know, sniper's gun. And he sits there just shooting inmates randomly for fun, right?
Yeah, just popping them off.
Now, that was done as an example of the evil of the Nazis, right? But what if I were to tell you that Israel does a very similar type of thing in Gaza to people in Gaza? I mean, they do this randomly. There's been cases where people just like sitting on the beach having a wedding were just machine gunned, because they have boats that are constantly patrolling up and down the coast of Gaza. And because of the blockade as well, the only way that... that the Gazans can feed themselves is by fishing, right? But the fishermen are under this constant cat and mouse game. They basically never know if they're going to be shot at when they just go out to try and catch some fish. And they're supposed to, by international law, be able to go, you know, at least 20 kilometres out. I mean, they're supposed to be, you know, an independent state or whatever, but that's another story. But, I mean, what's happened is that the Israel... doesn't let them go out more than 2 miles in their fishing boats. And even then, they sometimes shoot at them. They'll shoot at a fisherman. Now, you know, I know that we get accused that, oh, you shouldn't compare people to Nazis. But, I mean, that was a dramatized thing that you saw in a Hollywood movie, right? But that sort of thing occurs right now in Israel. And I think it's the sort of thing that occurs in any situation where you actually have an oppressive, you know, colonial power that's sort of like, you know, trying to totally crush the people that it considers to be its sort of, I don't know, it's something that's we've seen in history many times before, like the conquering power that just tries to crush another people. And they use it almost as a nationalist tool as well, because it pumps them up. You know, look at us.
Could you imagine, Harold, if someone was patrolling the Australian ocean, the Australian border, and was just popping off Aussies on the beach having a wedding? I mean, could you imagine? Yeah. It would probably spark World War III. I mean, the Americans would jump on board. Yeah. You know, it would just be insanity. But it seems to me like anything can happen in that area of the world now. And everyone goes, look, it'll never end. It's just that part of the world. That's what they do. They should just turn the place into a glass plate and get it over and done with. You know, that sort of language you hear from people, like, it's a lost cause, forget about it. It's really a sad state of affairs for humanity that the rest of the world gives such a little care.
I'm not laughing because it's funny, by the way. I'm laughing.
No, I mean, ridiculous. It's laughable because it's so sick. I mean, it's just ridiculous that humanity has become so immune to war, so immune to the war in the Middle East that no one really thinks about. And I really congratulate and standing ovation for these filmmakers, because this is a really good way to bring out the and pull the heartstrings of people again.
Yeah.
So we'll have that link up on the website.
We'll be back.
Oops, sorry.
And also on the Twitter feed. Folks, we really try to do the best we can on this show on the tiniest budget we can. I mean, it's literally runs on the smell of an oily rag. So we don't ask for donations or anything as yet. What we do ask, though, is that you tell your friends, you know, or post the links on forums that are talking about certain topics. If we talk about a topic, find a forum somewhere and post the link and say, hey, guys, have a listen to their opinion. You know, really, to get this show out, you know, we really would appreciate your help because we're so busy trying to, you know, we take on the battles of the internet filtering. We don't only do the show, you know, we're out there actually on the ground as well. And we don't have time to promote the show. So we really want our listeners to promote the show for us. You know, dig the show, put on Dig, stick it on Tumblr and Facebook. You know, Facebook's a really good one. Do YouTube it, you know. If you've got a YouTube account, stick a picture behind it and upload the whole or just a segment of the show that you're passionate about.
Yeah.
Onto YouTube, you know, it would really and put a link back to Truth News because truthnews.com.au really needs your help. And if we can't get the help spreading the show, then we can't do this show for much longer. You know, it's really neat and that's serious, guys. You know, we really need people to help out, and if they can financially help, you know, that would be much appreciated too.
Yeah, no, that's you're absolutely right there. It's been a great show. I think we're going to go out today with I'm going to play the first half of an interview with Amy Goodman that did with Professor Norman Finkelstein, but I think we'll just go out with that. And it's really important to I think alert listeners to some of these shows and things because sometimes people don't have a chance to keep up to speed with everything. And this particular interview that Amy Goodman did with Professor Finkelstein is a really important one. Again, it's about the Israel question, but he's a Jew, okay, and he's one of these great people. He's just one of these great humanitarians, and you'll be really amazed if you haven't heard this guy speak before at what he says. So I'm just gonna kick it off, and we're gonna finish up the show with that. The full interview you can always download from Democracy Now. But thanks again for everyone's support listening. Thanks, Josh, for tonight.
No workers.
Okay, well, look, it's over and out from Truth News Australia.
Cheers, folks. See you next week.
Cheers.
Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdelkaddous.
Well, healthcare is not the only issue on President Obama's agenda today. He's also scheduled to meet with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at the White House. Last night, Netanyahu delivered a defiant speech before an AIPAC conference. That's the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Netanyahu vowed to continue expanding settlements in occupied East Jerusalem, despite criticism from the Obama White House.
Ladies and gentlemen, the connection between the Jewish people and the land of Israel cannot be denied. The connection between the Jewish people and Jerusalem cannot be denied. The Jewish people were building Jerusalem 3,000 years ago, and the Jewish people are building Jerusalem today. Jerusalem is not a settlement. It's our capital.
Hours before Netanyahu spoke at the AIPAC conference, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton told AIPAC attendees that the U.S. commitment to Israel's security and Israel's future is rock solid. But Clinton did criticize Israel for continuing to build settlements in occupied East Jerusalem.
New construction in East Jerusalem or the West Bank undermines that mutual trust and endangers the proximity talks that are the first step toward the full negotiations that both sides say they want and need. And it exposes daylight between Israel and the United States that others in the region hope to exploit. It undermines America's unique ability to play a role, an essential role, in the peace process. Our credibility in this process depends in part on our willingness to praise both sides when they're courageous and when we don't agree to say so, and say so unequivocally.
We're joined now here in studio by scholar and writer Norman Finkelstein. He's author of a number of books on the Israel-Palestine conflict. His latest is being released this week. It's called This Time We Went Too Far: Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. Norman Finkelstein is also the subject of a new documentary called American Radical: The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. Norman, welcome to Democracy Now! Thank you. First, respond to what both Secretary of State Clinton and the Israeli Prime Minister said. Secretary of State Clinton actually criticizing Israel. Did that surprise you?
It didn't really surprise me. I think one has to look at the framework of the criticism. There is an international law ruling or opinion on the question of East Jerusalem. In July 2004, the highest judicial body in the world, the International Court of Justice, it rendered what it called its advisory opinion. And it stated unequivocally that East Jerusalem is, and now I'm using its words, occupied Palestinian territory. There's not a question here of conflicting claims to Jerusalem, let alone an Israeli exclusive right to East Jerusalem. The law is clear. It's occupied Palestinian territory because it was acquired in the course of a war, in the course of the June 1967 war. And under international law, it's inadmissible to acquire territory by war. I would want to add that that's the position of all human rights organizations, and it was the position of the Goldstone Report. The Goldstone Report repeatedly refers to East Jerusalem as occupied Palestinian territory. And Mr. Goldstone, by his own reckoning, is a Zionist, a lover of Israel, but he also respects the law. And the law is clear.
Well, let's talk about the Goldstone Report. You write about this extensively in the epilogue of your book. Israel and the U.S. have both rejected the war crimes allegations in the report. Talk about what the report is, who put it together, Judge Goldstone, and what the reaction from the U.S. and Israel has been.
The Goldstone Report was mandated by the United Nations Human Rights Council. Richard Goldstone, a distinguished international jurist, led the mission, and he, at the end, they published a quite substantial report that ran to some 500 pages, 550 pages. It covered a lot of ground, and it has to be said it was quite devastating in its indictment of Israel. It concluded that Israel used disproportionate force to punish, humiliate, and terrorize a civilian population. Well, Israel was outraged by the report across the spectrum, not just the right wing, but people like Shimon Peres, who's said to be a dove. He called Richard Goldstone a small man who knows nothing about international law. Michael Oren, the Israeli ambassador to the United States, said the Goldstone Report is worse than the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and worse than Ahmadinejad. And the reaction was quite similar in the United States. And Goldstone replied after the criticism in the U.S. He said, okay, you say the report is deeply flawed. Show me where. And to this day, and I've read all the critiques, there have been three major ones, one by this Israeli and American professor Moshe Halbertal. There was one by Professor Dershowitz of Harvard. And the Israelis put out just last week a 500-page rebuttal. And I tried, honestly, to look at it objectively. but they were very insubstantial responses. I was quite impressed by how well Goldstone has held up to the criticism. It was a very careful, cautious, and judicious report.
And its conclusion?
Its conclusion was that both Israel and Hamas were guilty of war crimes and possible crimes against humanity, that Israel has now an obligation to investigate, an independent investigation of what happened, and if they don't conduct an independent investigation, they have to go before the International Criminal Court.
And Obama's response to this?
The Obama administration has called the report deeply flawed, but not provided any substantive evidence to support that claim.
And this latest flap between the U.S. and Israel about the expanding Jewish housing in East Jerusalem, mm-hmm. It's been a lot about diplomatic ties, but they have not talked at all about holding any U.S. military aid or economic mm-hmm. aid to Israel. Talk about the level of aid to Israel. In fact, Hillary Clinton extolled the fact that it's increased in 2010, military aid to Israel.
Well, I'm sure all of your listeners and your viewers are familiar with the magnitude of U.S. aid to Israel. I think the important development is what Amnesty International said after the invasion of Gaza. It put out a very substantial report called Fueling Conflict, and it said that transferring weapons to a consistent violator of human rights is illegal under international law. Israel is a consistent violator of human rights, and therefore there has to be a comprehensive arms embargo on Israel. And the report went into each country in the world, how it supplies and transfers weapons to Israel. But it has to be said, the focus was on the United States. And Amnesty International said three main things. Number one, that the U.S. is by far the biggest supplier of weapons to Israel. Number two, supplying those weapons to Israel is not only illegal under international law, it's illegal under domestic U.S. law. And number three, it said, and I think it's important for your viewers to hear it, Amnesty International said what happened in Gaza could, and they described what happened in Gaza as 22 days of death and destruction. What happened in Gaza could not have happened were it not for U.S. taxpayer money. If you're appalled by what happened in Gaza, you're appalled by the death, the destruction, the systematic attack on mosques, the systematic attack on ambulances, the systematic attack on hospitals, on schools.
And these are detailed in the Goldstone report?
Yes. The 6,000 homes, which were all either completely or nearly completely destroyed, Amnesty International says all of that was paid for with U.S. taxpayer money. And now along comes Hillary Clinton, and she's extolling U.S. military aid to Israel. The part that she left out is, number one, it's all illegal under international and domestic U.S. law. And number two, it was that U.S. aid that made possible. You have to bear in mind, I know your program chronicled the use of the white phosphorus. Every white phosphorus shell they found, you can see it in the Human Rights Watch report in the white phosphorus. Every one was made in the United States. We are responsible for that war. And that's just, it's not just a cliche. It's a factual matter. We made that massacre happen.
This Time We Went Too Far is the name of your new book out mm-hmm. this week, a quote.
Yeah, the quote comes from the Israeli columnist Gideon Levy, and I think it captured the essence of the book, namely that Israel crossed a threshold with what it did in Gaza, because it was actually, in the past, you can say, Israeli conflicts with its neighbors had both a military component and a component that targeted civilians. Usually the component that targeted civilians was on par or even larger than the component of military engagement. But Gaza was not about it's not a war because there was no military engagement. As one of Israel's strategic analysts said, there was no war in Gaza. There were no battles in Gaza. and Israel conducted or executed a massacre against a defenseless civilian population, and it became indefensible. And that's why, to this day, quite a lot of time has already elapsed, and you would think people had forgotten about the Gaza massacre. It's already a year and a half. People's memories are short. But they can't, Israel has been unable to escape the shadow, the ghost of Gaza, in part because they went too far, and in part because of the Goldstone Report. Because typically Israel uses the slurs of anti-Semite, Holocaust denier, self-hating Jew in order to discredit the critics of its policies. But with Richard Goldstone, given his background, a Zionist, a lover of Israel, sits in the board of governors of the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. His mother was an activist in the Zionist movement. His daughter did Aliyah to Israel. Those slurs just didn't stick with Goldstone. And actually, Netanyahu, in one of his speeches, he said one of our three biggest challenges, he listed first the threat posed by Iran, and the second biggest challenge he listed was the Goldstone Report.
Well, Norman, speaking of criticism of people who criticize Israeli foreign policy, there's a new documentary about you called American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. I want to turn to a clip of it. This bit, it talks about how the Israeli-Palestinian conflict first piqued your interest.
My first involvement publicly and politically with the Israel-Palestine conflict was the Israeli invasion of Lebanon in June 1982. The estimates are, somewhere around 20,000 Palestinian and Lebanese, overwhelmingly civilians, were killed. Immediately as the war began, I start to demonstrate outside the Israeli consulate, right off 42nd Street. I was out there every day, every night, and I had a big poster which read, "This son of survivors of the Warsaw Ghetto, Auschwitz, and Majdanek will not be silent. Israeli Nazis stop the Holocaust in Lebanon." I did manage to get all of that on one poster. And so I started to read voraciously on the Israel-Palestine conflict.
That's an excerpt of the new documentary, American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. Norman, your thoughts about this movie, and also talk about your own family's history. It's very interesting. It goes through, talks about your parents, both Holocaust survivors. And also, if you can talk about Benjamin Netanyahu referencing the Holocaust yesterday in his speech to AIPAC.
Well, I've not actually seen the movie, but those who are close friends of mine and did see it, most of them, not all, but most of them thought it was an accurate depiction of me, for better or for worse. It's like the Chinese proverb, that you live in interesting times. I'm not sure if that's a compliment or not, but they say it's accurate. My parents obviously had a huge impact on me, especially morally. My mother was very smart, but she did not like to discuss war in intellectual terms because she felt to intellectualize it was somehow to not capture the horror of what war was. So during, let's say, the Vietnam War, when we used to watch Firing Line, and there would be debates between William Buckley and John Kent Galbraith, or William Buckley and, the fellow's name just slips my mind. And then they would, at the end of the debate, they would get up and shake hands and pat each other on the back. And it was like, my mother was so appalling. You're debating life and death and dropping napalm on kids, and then at the end you just get up and shake hands, like it's not serious. So at that point in my life, I found it very hard to talk rationally about war, and I felt it was a betrayal of my parents to have intellectual debates about it. And I think until I started to read Professor Chomsky's writings, and I found that you can have a reasoned argument and still preserve the moral force behind your feelings. Until I read him, I was not very articulate in talking about it. Now I feel pretty able to.
Norman, we just have less than a minute to go. You end "This Time We Went Too Far" by mentioning Gandhi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I spent the last year reading through about 25,000 pages of Gandhi, which is about half his collected works. I found him a deeply inspiring figure, both personally and politically. And I think his approach can work in the Israel-Palestine conflict. It would take me some time to go through it because Gandhi's not nearly as obvious as people think. They just think Gandhi, nonviolence. No, there was a quite subtle, nuanced theory there. But I think what he has to say is relevant to the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I think the strategy that's now being used by Palestinians around the wall and in East Jerusalem, the kinds of tactics that Gandhi pioneered, I think those have the best chances for success.
Norman Finkelstein, his book out this week, This Time We Went Too Far, Truth and Consequences of the Gaza Invasion. The film is also out. It's called American Radical, The Trials of Norman Finkelstein. That does it for our show. If you'd like a copy, go to our website. Happy birthday to Miriam Bernard. I'm Amy Goodman with Sharif Abdul-Qudus. Thanks for joining us.
Propaganda. Disinformation. Misinformation. Deception. Untruths, half-truths, lies, inner the truth. Looking for something different? Visit Truth News Radio Australia, www.truthnews.com.au.